Hello and welcome back to DebtWired, where we break down everything debt-related with expert insights. I'm Elena Halkia, and today we're diving into how debt markets are responding to shifting monetary policy and rising geopolitical tensions. Markets are in flux, and with interest rates shaping the future of fixed income, there's a lot to unpack. Just this past Sunday, President Trump said he will impose a 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports, following last week's tariff announcements on Mexico, Canada, and China. These moves have certainly heightened global trade tensions and raised concerns about broader economic fallout. Meanwhile, 10-year Treasury yields are hovering around 4.5%, and investors are questioning how to position their portfolios in this changing environment. To help us break it all down, I want to bring in Tom Kennedy, Chief Investment Strategist for JP Morgan Private Bank. Tom, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first start by setting the stage for what 2025 could look like. Given the Fed announcements and the ongoing economic uncertainty, What's your outlook on interest rates?
Well, everything on interest rates is going to start with the economy. If you look back over the last 10 years, if you knew exactly where the Fed funds rate would be in 1 year's time, you could dictate where the 10-year treasury would be today. I'm going to date myself a little bit. Maybe you've seen the movie Back to the Future, where Michael J. Fox goes into the future, gets the almanac, comes back. That's what it's like to be an interest rate strategist here. You have to know where the Fed is going to be. And that's why on Wall Street, you look around and there's a lot of ex-Fed people like myself walking around in interest rate roles. So everything starts with the economy. When you look at the economy right now in America, it's in a very strong position, but a very unique position. Over the last 2 years, economists have been underestimating growth persistently. Every quarter, you're seeing expectations for growth below what realized growth outcomes become. Normally, in that time, you'd say, wow, inflation should be surprising to the upside, or the labor market should be tightening. And neither one of those things have been happening. So it's a very unique experience. I think the economy is on strong footing, but a unique one.
And what's your expectation, I guess? Do you still expect 3 rate cuts for this year?
Yeah, from the Fed, we're still expecting them to cut rates. At the January FOMC meeting, Powell told the world that he still sees rates as meaningfully restrictive. And that surprised some folks that the economy can still be performing as well as it is and still think rates might be too high. I think most of the folks that think rates are meaningfully restrictive, they're looking at the housing market and how slow existing home sales are. You can also look at other places where there's interest rate sensitive spending. If you're going to go out and buy a car, as an example, lending activity or purchases there are still below where we were pre-COVID. I think rates are meaningfully restricted. We just don't know how much that is, how to quantify. In our baseline, we see growth remaining roughly constant to what it is now, the labor market staying tight, and inflation cooling towards about 2.5% by the end of this year. And in a pretty simple Fed model that says you should be cutting a few more times. So that's our baseline. But given the uncertainty that's out there, monetary and fiscal, that's a wide range. I think the market's going to move around quite a bit around that expectation.
And in this macroeconomic landscape, we're also seeing growing trade tensions. Trump's latest tariffs and the uncertainty around Canada and Mexico, these have all raised questions and concerns about inflation and economic growth. How do you see this play out for high yield markets?
I think first we can look back to President Trump's first term. Tariff uncertainty was high for more or less the entirety of his term, meaning this is a tool that he has historically shown he likes to use to wield his influence. First and foremost, we're expecting this to be a tool that's around. We're not expecting it to be over very, very soon. The real question becomes, what's the end game? What is the Trump administration really trying to do with the tariffs? Are they just trying to find reciprocity, meaning more trade balance with other countries? Most other countries charge tariffs on goods imported from America more than what we charge goods imported from their country. So it could be that. Could also be some sort of security. Maybe you need more secure supply chains following a pandemic, following rising geopolitical risks. We really don't know. If I had President Trump or his administration here, that's the question I'd ask him. What is the end game? But we think this uncertainty will be around for a while. Tariffs in of themselves for the economy are a stagflationary risk, where inflation goes up and growth doesn't go up commensurately, or maybe even growth goes down. And the way to bring that to life is just think about a phone. You're going to buy an iPhone. And if it's 25% higher than what you thought it would be, but your wages don't go up 25%, you're crowding out your ability to spend elsewhere. So inflation up, growth down. in that environment, it's very unclear what the Fed would do. And we're getting the transcripts from the first Trump administration. For the most part, the Fed looked through the inflationary impacts and focused on the growth impacts. It remains to be seen. We don't know. This is a big part of the uncertainty.
Of course, again, amid all this uncertainty and volatility, we're also seeing treasury yields that have fluctuated quite a bit in the past couple of months, and they reached high levels. What's driving this move?
Yeah.
And how do you see it unfolding moving from here?
We take a simple statistical technique to try to look at what cross-asset price action is doing and try to infer something from it. As an example, if treasury yields were higher, the equity market was higher, and the dollar appreciated, you would say that's a growth shock. Growth surprised you to the upside. But we can start to assign specific trading days to different outcomes, whether it be uncertainty, growth, monetary policy. And since the Fed started cutting rates in September, treasury yields are up 80, 85 basis points. And that's defying historical norms. Usually when they're cutting, 10-year rates are going down. This is opposite. This is different. That move higher in yields is mostly from positive growth surprises, but also this uncertainty we're talking about. And the uncertainty is both monetary and fiscal. We really hit on the fiscal already, but the Fed is in an uncertain term too. The economy is surprising them. They don't know what meaningfully restrictive really means. So there's a lot of uncertainty for them too. It's twofold. It's both growth and uncertainty that's driving rates higher.
So moving forward, should we expect, given the economic backdrop that we talk about, should we expect yields to remain elevated or increase even further?
Our baseline is you'll see rates around these levels at year end. But from here to year end is likely to be very volatile. Interest rate volatility as measured by the options market is structurally higher than what we had pre-COVID. The word structurally means just it's been that way for a couple of years. And I think the reason it's high is this level of uncertainty that we're talking about. Our baseline is you're going to see a volatile ride to more or less end in the same place at the end of the year.
How do you see this environment impact risk assets and specifically high yield debt?
This is a good environment for risk assets. The biggest, deepest market for risk assets is the S&P 500. We're about two-thirds through earnings season right now. About 75% of businesses that have reported so far are beating their earnings estimates. That's about the five-year average. So a healthy earnings growth backdrop. But importantly, we're expecting this year, 2025, to see earnings growth accelerate from about 8% earnings growth in 2024 to almost 15% and broadening out. The reason to lead with that before you talk about high yield is to say it's very odd to think earnings would accelerate, yet defaults would go up and companies would do layoffs. It's very odd to think that would happen. At the moment, high yield spreads are very tight, you know, in the 1 or 2 percentile of history over the last 20 years. But it somewhat makes sense. If you think that earnings growth will accelerate, it's very unlikely defaults will pick up. So I think this backdrop is constructive for high yield investors earning a coupon 7.5%. I think you should expect minimal price appreciation, but coupon of a very healthy 7%.
And given this outlook and, you know, we talked about, as you mentioned, spread compression, but also the treasury yields, what's your view on adding duration and credit risk into portfolios at this stage?
I think first you have to recognize the uncertainty that is here. A couple of different avenues to walk down. When there's high levels of uncertainty, you should expect volatility to be high. And are you getting compensated enough for that type of volatility? We think at the end of the year, treasury rates are going to end roughly in the same place we are today. So we feel comfortable owning duration. It's just what you're owning it for. You're owning it for the income. The likelihood of price appreciation is quite low. In a really simple term, people buy fixed income for three reasons, either the income, the diversification, or the price appreciation potential. I think right now it's a focus on that income. So finding really good income is top of the list.
And I remember we chatted a little bit about the direct lending opportunities that you're seeing. That's certainly such an interesting perspective because, of course, private credit and direct lending are gaining so much traction.
Yeah.
How should investors think about incorporating direct lending into their portfolios?
I think everyone needs to take a real look at this asset class and fight against the notion that this is a bubble or a fad. JP Morgan's in a luxurious position. Direct lending is loans to middle market businesses instead of given from a bank, as it had been done for decades, being done from an asset manager. JP Morgan, from what we can tell, provides about half of the leverage into that community at the asset manager level. What am I saying? Asset manager raises funds, gives out a loan, and they add leverage. And JP Morgan is the one that adds leverage at the portfolio level. Why even talk about it? It gives me a unique perspective into what's happening in that market. At the moment, the average direct loan that's being given is picking up spread of 500 basis points to SOFR. So you're talking about a yield 9 to 10%. The business is risky. It's 4.5 times levered. That's pretty consistent with a B-rated credit that you and I would look at and feel. And these are generally tech businesses, software businesses, maybe some healthcare businesses. So number one is know what's in there. This is a growing part of the financing ecosystem away from banks towards direct lenders. I think the market has found an equilibrium, and I don't see excessive activity happening there. So if you're an investor looking for income, you're talking 9 or 10% for a B-rated credit, whereas that B-rated credit in the leveraged loan market or the high yield market is closer to 7.5%. That's yield pickup that I think people who can give up the liquidity should consider.
Should we expect this trend between the public markets and direct lending to continue?
I think that's a constant push and pull. And how the Trump administration handles deregulation for banks could have an impact. Part of what's made this ecosystem grow direct lending is that from a regulatory perspective, it's harder for banks to do the things that they traditionally did. They need more capital. They need more liquidity to do that. So if the Trump administration goes through a meaningful deregulation on banks that frees up liquidity and capital, they may try to take some of this market share back. But at the moment, I think it's going to be very hard to compete with some of the benefits of being in direct lending. If I'm a borrower, I don't have to tell the world what my financials look like. I don't have to report it to the world every quarter. The benefits, it's not necessarily anonymity, but it's just the lack of requirements to show everyone what I have creates some flexibility that I think will be enticing. So I think this ecosystem is here to stay. How quickly it ramps is the question.
There's been so much talk about the collaboration between these two. In your perspective, are we going to see more of these partnerships between the private and the public markets? Is that a good thing?
I do think we're going to see more partnership, to use your word. I think I would just call it more development and maturation of that ecosystem, in that banks are still connected to what these loans are doing, just in a different manner. It's part of the reason why I talk about how JP Morgan's giving the financing to the asset manager. They're still involved. They're just using their balance sheet in a different way, the bank, and the asset manager is growing now as a new viable source of capital. This ecosystem is just going to keep growing and building. How quickly it does, I think, is predicated on the Trump administration. If you're comfortable to invest your money in a leveraged loan market, it's pretty interesting to think you would not be interested in the direct lending space. They're almost the same loan. It's just being given by a different person or a different entity. So I think it's definitely something to consider. And what we're going to see is now, how does direct lending and private credit democratize? How is it going to spread to other investors beyond just big institutional investors? So that's an interesting development to follow in the next couple of years too.
What other investors would that incorporate exactly?
You're talking getting into smaller retail investors where you'll be able to offer loans at a much smaller bite size, if you will. Maybe you only want to invest $10,000 in a pool of these direct loans. That's something to consider too. That's part of the democratization.
And we're mostly talking about loans here, but bonds have also started to pick up, and we expect this trend again for this year. Now, bonds, as we've discussed before, bonds have traditionally provided income and diversification benefits in multi-asset portfolios. But that inverse correlation with stocks hasn't really held since the Fed started hiking rates. Do you expect that to change, or should investors rethink their fixed income allocations entirely?
It's going on 3 years now where stocks and bonds are positively correlated. And what does that mean? As stocks go down in value, bonds have been going down in value. It doesn't tell you the magnitude, but it's telling you the direction of travel. Prior to COVID, dating back all the way to more or less the year 2000, we had a 20-year run where stocks and bonds were persistently inversely correlated. And the 60-40 portfolio as the optimal portfolio is predicated on inverse correlation between stocks and bonds, the diversification. And we just have to let the data tell us enough. It's been 3 years where that hasn't been true. And it doesn't mean multi-asset investing doesn't have benefits. It does challenge what's the right mix of stocks and bonds. But it gets back to the point. You buy fixed income for three reasons: diversification, income, and the potential for price appreciation. The diversification is just not there. For global multi-asset investors, you've got to rethink a little bit. First and foremost, do you like the yield in your fixed income? And most people should like it. This is the best opportunity set we've had since before the global financial crisis. yields are attractive. But for the diversification benefits, when we're in this phase, fixed income, core fixed income is not the best place to be. We're actually advocating for clients to think, find your income, set that aside. For diversification, you need to think about maybe real estate, infrastructure, or maybe even structured notes as things that can provide you some ballast to a portfolio characteristics that you're not going to get in the one-stop shop of core fixed income.
And to dive a little bit deeper into kind of where you see those opportunities in the debt markets, where are the most attractive income opportunities right now?
It's a land of tight spreads. Spreads are tight everywhere. So where can you find some spread in extended credit? It's mostly in securitized products. Securitized products are not generally accessible for most single investors, institutions for sure. If to get access to this type of market, and what is it? It's commercial mortgage-backed securities. It's agency mortgage-backed securities. These are more complex products. I think you want an institutional portfolio manager to help you get there. But in the land of tight spreads, this is the only place where there is spread. So when you're looking for income, like a go anywhere fixed income manager can really help you get into some of these crevices, if you will, of the fixed income market that are not generally as talked about.
And these go anywhere funds, what do they encompass exactly?
A go anywhere fund is just that. It can go anywhere in the fixed income space, and it can also go anywhere globally. But a go anywhere fund is mostly the ones that we're investing in are leaning much more heavily into securitized product where there is spread and there's a potential for outperformance. When spreads are really tight, what you're saying is, I really don't think that my price of my bond can go up anymore. So I'm just going to get income. In the securitized space, there is maybe some potential for price appreciation. So that's really what you're looking for. But in this land of tight spreads, you have to adapt and try something new and different. The reason spreads are, I think, are really tight in leveraged loans and high yield is it's what we always talk about. It's the market you and I know. It's what we've gotten comfortable with. So I'm willing to push that price a little bit more. But if history is any guide, which maybe it's not in this go around, spreads are going to be challenged to go much tighter than where we are.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Tom, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to our listeners for checking out this episode of DebtWired. As always, you can subscribe or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at DebtWired.com. See you next time.